Coming up on Boston Public Radio, so the shutdown is over. But will Shutdown the sequel be coming to a theater near you in mid-January? Then Valerie Plame, outed as a covert CIA officer nearly a decade ago, she joins us. And is her new novel, Blowback, really a work of fiction? And you know those letters schools were sending home telling parents their kid had a weight problem? Well, they are no more. Marjorie praises the decision in her Herald column, but as a formerly overweight kid myself, I'm not so sure.
Open mic with Christopher Lydon on the end of American exceptionalism, ? And Kara Miller on the blockbuster effect, how blockbuster movies and media and blockbusters are squeezing out what's really valuable. All that on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A lot of reflection in Washington this first day post-government shutdown. President Obama says the U.S. economy has suffered completely unnecessary damage from the budget impasse and the threat of default on federal debt. Obama signed legislation just after midnight to end the shutdown and raise the debt limit. NPR's Craig Windham reports the president says the spectacle that has been playing out in Washington has damaged the nation's credibility around the world.
The president says the bitter partisan showdown over the debt ceiling and government shutdown leaves Americans disheartened about their government.
The American people are completely fed up with Washington.
Obama is calling on Congress to work on a federal budget and to pass immigration reform and farm bills by the end of the year.
Those are three specific things that would make a huge difference in our economy right now.
The president says although there are sharp differences between the parties, members of Congress are all Americans.
And that's why disagreement cannot mean dysfunction.
And Obama adds that disagreements must not degenerate into hatred. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
The GOP is looking to move on from this latest budget debacle that has drawn the ire of a public increasingly disenchanted with Democrats and more so with Republicans, according to the polls. At a joint House-Senate committee breakfast this morning, House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan pledged to work toward avoiding a repeat of the impasse when fiscal deadlines approach after the first of the year.
Our goal is to do good for the American people, to get this debt under control, to do smart deficit reduction, and to do things that we think can grow the economy and get people back to work.
A lot of federal workers are likely removing out-of-office messages from their email and voicemail on this first day back to work in 16 days. At the Environmental Protection Agency, nearly all employees were furloughed, and they received an unexpected welcome from Vice President Joe Biden. In other news, Mauritania in West Africa tops a new global slavery index. NPR's Afabia Quist-Arkton reports that Haiti and Pakistan also rank among the nations with the highest rates of modern slavery, according to the index compiled by a leading anti-slavery charity.
The Walk Free Foundation estimates how many people in a given nation are affected by a range of practices, including forced and bonded labor, human trafficking, forced marriages, and using children in the military. Proportionately, Mauritania is top of the list. The charity says the West African nation, which has outlawed slavery, has the highest proportion of enslaved individuals, between 140 and 160,000. That's 4%. Of its population. Many of Mauritania's modern-day slaves inherited their status from their ancestors. Ofebi Akwistarkton, NPR News, Lagos.
Dow is down 50 points at 15,323. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon from the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston. I'm Christina Quinn with the local stories we're following. Gates have reopened to visitors this morning at Cape Cod National Seashore and other federal sites closed for more than 2 weeks by the federal shutdown that ended overnight. In Boston, park rangers opened gates and took down signs informing people of the shutdown at the USS Constitution in Charlestown. The Bunker Hill Monument and the Minuteman National Historic Park are among other government facilities reopening. American women are increasingly using donated eggs to get pregnant, often with good results, according to new research. The findings were presented at a medical conference in Boston. What the researchers call the ideal outcome happens in only about 1 out of 4 pregnancies from donor eggs, but that's up from 19% a decade ago. The ideal is a single baby born on time at a healthy weight. More than a third of donor egg babies are twins, and many are born preterm. The state is reopening 250 acres of clam flats in Newburyport that had been shut down for the last 80 years. A section of the Joppa Flat in the Merrimack River estuary is reopening to clam harvesters after being closed for bacterial contamination for decades. State officials are setting some limits, with harvesting only on weekdays and clams having to be cleansed at a state marine fisheries plant. In Rhode Island, a task force is reviewing why the state doesn't provide its mental health records to the national database used for firearm background checks. Rhode Island is now one of only a handful of states that does not share its mental health records with the FBI's background check system. Lawmakers say they want to look for ways to keep guns out of the hands of those with severe mental illness without violating the Second Amendment or stigmatizing those who struggle with psychological illness. Support for NPR comes from Constant Contact, offering small businesses online tools like social media, event, and email marketing from one login at constantcontact.com. Mostly sunny skies this afternoon with temperatures in the lower 70s, mostly cloudy tonight with a chance of showers after midnight. At 12:06, it's 68 degrees in Boston.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
So the shutdown is over, Marjorie. The debt limit rises. The close for business signs are coming down. And tomorrow, this is the great news, the Panda Cam will be up and running again.
God, thank God.
Everybody knows that yesterday, congressional Republicans conceded defeat in their bitter budget battle with President Obama. In a couple of minutes, we'll be joined by Todd Zwillick. As you know, he's the D.C. correspondent. For the takeaway, he'll tell us whether we're deja vu all over again is in our future. But now let's get your sense of what happened and what the future holds at 877-301-8970. I know it's very hard. Everything is relative. But I have to say, and maybe I have a short memory, this is one of the most pathetic 16 plus days in American political history. Yesterday was even more pathetic. I'm watching the news a couple of minutes ago, Marjorie. Mm-hmm. Paul Ryan, the House budget chair, a Republican, obviously, who's Mitt Romney's vice presidential nominee, and Patty Murray, who's the Senate Democratic budget chair, had breakfast and a meeting. It was being celebrated on CNN. I don't mean by CNN itself, but by politicians last night as this major breakthrough in American budgetary policy. And they went on to say, people like Dana Bash were saying on CNN, they hadn't had such a meeting in years. The Democratic budget chair had not met with the Republican budget chair. It is pathetic. And I, for one, hold out no hope that we're not going to go through this whole nightmare all over again in January.
Well, one of the things that you think may give some of the Republicans that are very opposed to this conciliatory approach cause for pause is, what was it, $27 billion is the estimated
$24 billion
cost
allegedly across the economy.
Billions and billions and billions of dollars. And we can't afford this. Things are, you know.
You're kidding, right? Their response would be Obamacare is going to cost us trillions.
I know, but I would think that the after they got not a single movement at all on Obamacare, that maybe their constituents would say, you know something, this is costing people money. I mean, obviously in Washington, it was most you felt the great effects there because of the small businesses, et cetera. But I don't think anybody wants to risk their own savings, their own 401ks, paying higher interest rates and all those kinds of things, even if you are vehemently and adamantly and to the death opposed to Obamacare.
I hope you don't take this in the wrong way. You know what your problem is?
What?
You are rational. This has rationality has absolutely nothing to do with this. I don't know if you were listening to people last night on television and the radio. Some of the leaders of the Tea Party caucus, some of the people who are part of the Ted Cruz axis were emboldened. They were not chastened by what happened. They said, we lost this round. And you know why they lost the round? Because they didn't fight hard enough and because moderate Republicans did not join us in this fight. In any case, we're going to get to you in a couple of minutes at 877-301-8970. But as promised, we're joined on the phone by Todd Zwillick. He's the D.C. correspondent for The Takeaway. One caution, Todd, you may not use the term kick the can down the road at any point during this interview. Are you up to that? Todd?
Be tempted, but yeah, avoid cliches at all costs.
Okay, as long as you're in on the deal, that's fine.
So we were just having a mini debate here in studio, Todd, before you joined us. I mean, I am mildly optimistic that because of the billions of dollars lost here and the complete surrender of Republicans here, the people that were so opposed to Obamacare, that maybe we're not going to see this again. You know, we're only funded through January 15th and the debt ceilings goes up, you know, the limit is reached on February 7th, that we're not going to go through this again so soon. But what do you think?
Well, here's one for you. Time will tell.
Time will tell. Thank you.
Yeah. But it really depends on how the House Republican leadership decides to play their next hand here. There are some good signs, guys. Marjorie, you're right. One of the good things that's happening is there is a formal budget conference that's starting, and that's gobbledygook speak for they're actually going to negotiate over a budget, which hasn't happened in 4 years. Been a lot of different reasons for that. At first, Democrats were to blame for that, and then Republicans were to blame for the fact that there hasn't been a formal negotiation. Those negotiations are the basis for sort of regular order and how all this stuff is supposed to work on the Hill. The fact that they haven't had them is the reason we keep lurching from continuing resolution to shutdown crisis to fiscal cliff. It's all because they haven't been able to have these talks. So the fact that they're having them is good. Is there a way to reach an agreement? Now, the old argument over revenue is what this is going to be about. And part of the problem here is with all of the divisions and the sort of ongoing war right now in the Republican Party, you know, the Ted Cruz's versus McConnell's and Boehner's that sort of spilled out into open public warfare, they're all unified on the fact that they don't want a dollar in new revenue. And without new revenue, Democrats aren't going to agree to anything. So those talks could all fall apart. The political part of it is, have Republicans learned a lesson and they're not going to force another shutdown? Yes, they've probably learned that lesson. Over the debt limit, a lot of conservatives feel emboldened. They actually gained politically with their pace by this, and they might want to try it again. So it all depends on what lessons they've taken on how successful this new sort of budget discussion paradigm can be.
You know, Todd, I don't know John Boehner. Obviously, you spend a lot of time in and around him, so maybe you can do a little bit of a psychoanalysis. If I were given the choice as the Speaker of the House to be an historical figure, probably to go to the Kennedy Library in Dorchester, Massachusetts, and get a Profile in Courage Award handed to me by Caroline Kennedy, or be humiliated time and time again by 20 or 30 Tea Party members of my caucus, I choose Caroline Kennedy. Is there a point at which he's going to say, I can't cater to these people anymore? If I lose my speakership, so be it.
That is the operating question in Washington right now. You really, really put your finger on it. About a month ago, you know, some former aides to John Boehner started talking to reporters and sort of whisper story leaked out that this was his last Congress speaker, that he's going to resign. He's going to resign his speakership after this because doesn't want to do it anymore. Nobody knows except John Boehner if that's really true. His office, of course, denied it, as you do. That's sort of part of the sort of rote here. But, Jim, the thinking here is that if John Boehner is going to have this be his last speakership, then he has not only the latitude but the incentive to make the big Profile in Courage deal that you're talking about. If not, then he doesn't, because these 30 people on his right are really a rising and vocal and the activist wing, media-fueled wing of his party. So I think a lot of it has to do with that. Now, he's not the only one having this debate. You know, I talked to a guy yesterday called Aaron Schock. He's a younger congressman coming out of the House Republican Conference last night. He's a Boehner ally. He's a relative moderate. I mean, he would call himself a conservative. In these days, he's a relative moderate. And he said the lesson for him and that he's trying to spread around the conference for these budget negotiations is the lesson is we have to marginalize these people. They're never, ever, ever going to agree to anything the president can find. So we can just keep passing bills with 218 Republicans and staring ourselves in the mirror, or we can try to pass something that the Senate can actually deal with and the president can actually consider. And his view is you sort of take those 25 to 30 people and you say, you're out, and we'll get the votes from across the aisle. And that's a different kind of speakership for Boehner if he decides to pursue that.
Well, Todd Zwillich, that seems like a brilliant idea to me if you are not down with this small group of very radical Republicans. I'm surprised it hasn't been tried before. I mean, clearly Boehner, it doesn't share their same politics.
Well, he has done it before, except on much lower profile issues. The transportation bill was passed this way. It was passed with bipartisan votes. There have been a couple of other smaller issues. The Violence Against Women Act, which got a lot of media play,
that's a great point.
Relatively, I have to say, you know, not a huge high-profile legislative issue on the Hill, was passed in this way. So it has been clear since, you know, for pretty much the entire Obama presidency, at least since the economic collapse, that the big marquee issues, that this is the only way they get passed. I mean, you tell me, if immigration reform were going to come up for a House vote next week, what's the only way that bill would pass? It would pass just like the debt limit bill passed last night with 80 Republicans and 100 and, you know, all of the Democrats, 197 Democrats. That's the only way it would pass. Things can change between now and then, but this has been the dynamic. It's just that Boehner hasn't been very willing to do it on the high-profile issues of choice. You know, it's why the 2011 negotiations with Obama fell apart, because he wasn't able to do it.
Well, you sound, I don't want to characterize your feelings and emotions, but you sound at least open-minded on the question of whether there's a positive outcome. I have to say, I'm not quite there yet, but Todd, we'll keep listening, and hopefully you will get me and them there by January. Thank you so much, Todd Zwillich from The Takeaway. Really appreciate your time. Talk to you soon.
Always a pleasure, guys. Always a pleasure.
Todd Zwillich is the D.C. correspondent for The Takeaway, and you are invited now to call in. Are you relieved? Do you think we're going to see the shutdown? It's the sequel? Part 3, part 4, part 5, going on and on and on. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What do you think about the shutdown? Now, let me ask you a question. You don't know the answer to this.
I'll answer it anyway.
But again, you know, John Boehner is not a young guy. As Todd Zwillich said, he may be leaving, he may not. Another argument for term limits, actually, is what he was saying, that if he were resigning, he'd be doing the right thing instead of thinking about his own holding on to his job. But, I mean, you are aware of your legacy. You are aware of how you're going to be viewed down the road. Why does he not just, figuratively speaking, tell this the people that are the small group of radicals on the big stuff, too? See you later. Forget it. Drop dead.
You ever been in Boston and come upon either a former Massachusetts Senate president or a former Massachusetts speaker, one who was not indicted? But have you ever come upon one of those people after they left their job?
I think maybe I saw Finneran.
Well, I saw a lot of them. And what happens when they're walking alone? No one is calling them Your Excellency anymore. Nobody is slavishly whining and it's very seductive. Power is a really seductive thing.
I know
being the third in line to the presidency of the United States. I'm with you, but I think that power is something that a lot of people have a problem giving up, even if you have a place in history.
But in your heart of hearts, he knows that, okay, I'm going to be looked at the guy in history if I keep indulging these people as the person who indulged them solely to hold on to my power.
I'm not sure he will be. I think he'll be a footnote in history. And I'm not sure when you're in the middle of that thing, when everybody treats you like you're not a real human, mm-hmm. but like you are some special whatever, that you don't even, you're just not in.
Just one last thing before we get back to the call. I just want to repeat what I just said. Hear what Todd Zwillich just said.
What's that?
Todd Zwillich just said that if he were leaving, if he were resigning his speakership, he would be doing the right thing. But that's the question. If he's not going to resign, he probably won't do the right thing.
Well, you know who's got to do the right thing, too? A guy who is term limited, the President of the United States. And as we've discussed repeatedly, Marjorie, based on the Matt Visor column in the Globe the other day, maybe he has to start treating moderate Republicans like they're not a subspecies.
He's got to start
meet with them, wine and dine them.
Barbecues, cocktail parties.
Well, and also make him an offer they can't refuse. We'll get to your calls in about 30 seconds. Let him go to John Boehner and say, remember in that State of the Union speech when I said I would means test Medicare? It's on the table. Remember when, even though my liberal Democratic members hated the so-called chain CPI, which is the lower inflation adjustment to Social Security mm-hmm. benefits, that's on the table, too. I'm going to give you so many good things, moderate Republicans, that you'll have something to bludgeon your Tea Party colleagues with.
I'm fine for him becoming the big bargainer. I'm fine with that. I just think that so much of this, I mean, well, it's a bigger
it's a bigger discussion, but a lot of this is about money, and it's a lot of this is about people just holding on to their power, and it's very corrosive, and I wish I could persuade you to come to my side of the aisle on that one. But anyway, we'll go to the
calls. Term limits question.
Yes.
Yeah.
Suzanne from Newton. Thanks for calling Boston Public Radio, Suzanne. What do you think?
Hey.
Hi. First of all, I applaud you guys for being so rational because this is making me insane.
No, we're close to that too, actually.
Oh my God. And I don't yell at sports, but I yell it at the radio and not at you guys.
You can do that too.
Oh, but I am so, okay. I was saying to the screener, I said, really, I just want to say I'm right and you're wrong. And I want them to say we're wrong and you're right, you know? And I just am waiting for that day where somebody just wakes up and says, wow, that was a big fat mistake. Maybe we should try something else.
Well, let me tell you, Suzanne, you want to feel a little bit better? I'll tell you somebody
yes,
you should
I
Google.
Do.
Lindsey Graham, a close colleague
yes.
of John McCain, is a Republican senator from South Carolina. He was interviewed repeatedly last night, including by Anderson Cooper on CNN, and he pretty much said what you wanted to hear. We heard that 75% of the American people have utter contempt for the Republican Party, my Republican Party, he said. And I'm paraphrasing, we'd be fools to ignore it. We overplayed our hand. He literally said almost every word you want heard. The question is, do he and his colleagues, who are, as you say, semi-rational at least, do they have enough power to convince the others? And we shall see. Suzanne, feel better. Nice to talk to you.
But then there's a very annoying paragraph to those of us who are upset about this in the New York Times this morning about Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who, of course, he's the freshman Republican who came up with this idea to defund Obamacare and did the filibuster with the green eggs and ham and stuff.
Hours, yeah.
He withstood the weekly berating of his party elders with no apparent damage to his perpetually pleased grin. And he seemed to be reveling in the spotlight despite the losing end that his fellow Republicans.
3 weeks ago, he was not a household name. Now he is a household name. I would assume he considers that to be a plus. Kevin on Cape Cod, you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call. Hi, Kevin. Hello, Kevin. Kevin, we'll put you on hold. We'll go to John from Gardner. Hey, John, you're on Boston Public Radio.
Jim and Marjorie, how the heck are you?
We are excellent. Thank you for asking, John.
That's good. Speaking of Lindsey Graham, guess what's happening in his, is it North or South Carolina?
South Carolina.
They're already, you know, making him a target of a primary. I mean, that came out this morning.
Well, Mitch McConnell has a Tea Party Republican running against him. A lot of these Republicans
are. It's re-energized since this vote has happened already.
Yeah.
It's crazy. You mentioned that Hulls Camp guy, whatever it is.
Who?
Hulls Camp or Hulls something.
Whatever.
Oh, I don't know.
From Kansas.
Oh, Brian McGrory,
yesterday.
The editor of the
yes.
Globe, mentioned him when he was talking to us yesterday.
He was on several different media outlets the night before last.
Mm-hmm.
I was flipping around. I caught Megyn Kelly's new show at 9 o'clock. He was on with Louis Gohmert.
Mm-hmm.
We all know him from
yeah.
Texas, right?
And?
Louis Gohmert was the rational one. Megyn Kelly had all she could do to keep a straight face listening to these two guys.
John from Gardner, what's happened to Sean Hannity at 9 o'clock? Has he moved back later? Or is
I believe
he...
he's at 10 now. I can't even flip to him and watch even 10 seconds.
So, John, you don't sound terribly hopeful about the prospects for the next couple of months. Is that a safe assumption?
I hope I'm wrong, but I'm not. And
yeah.
Now the markets aren't even shaking them because they know that eventually they're going to do it at the 11th hour. At least in summer of 11, everything hit the fan in the market. And that scared them. But now the market knows that ultimately, probably, at the last hour, they'll do something. So the markets didn't even send them a
message. Yeah, but you know what the nightmare is that I wish we had mentioned earlier? And, John, thanks for the call. I forgot. When John King from CNN was with us, what day, Tuesday, he mentioned that when the term I said I wouldn't use, the kick term, down the road term, when he talked about that, he says, when you kick it into January and February of next year, you know what next year is? Midterm elections.
Yes, that's a great
which
point.
Makes it so much more difficult for compromise for people who are appealing to the more extreme elements of their own party. And I think he makes a great point. The opportunity is now, if it exists at all.
Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org, and you have a shout-out from Mark Jim, who says he couldn't agree with you more regarding the need for Obama to treat Republicans with respect. He's a Republican himself, that's Mark, and says the issue that drove me away from Obama was the disrespect he showed to Republicans in general, and Bush in particular. This, we inherited it stuff. Just drove
them. Let him put a wedge between the moderate Republicans and the Tea Party people. That's how he wins this thing. He, you know, allegedly this is a win. It's a very short term win. When you humiliate people and they get absolutely nothing, as you said before, it does not leave them in a wonderful state of mind. Even though they crossed the line, I'm not saying they didn't.
Revenge.
I think that's right. Let's take one more.
Obama saying this morning there's not going to be another stalemate, or he said it last night. Excuse me.
Yeah.
But I don't know why he thinks there's not going to be another one. Let's go to Tim in New Hampshire, or close to New Hampshire.
Hi, Tim.
Good afternoon, guys. I hope you can hear me well.
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Awesome. Remember when Bill Clinton was running for president and the mantra became, it's all about the economy?
Stupid. It's the economy, stupid, yes.
I left that part out.
Okay.
Well, we can change that up now, and we could have changed it up right around 2010 onward. It's all about taxes. And I absolutely hate it when I see a pundit on TV or hear a pundit on the radio, and they call it revenue. And the guy you just had on, he mentioned it, and he brought it right up to the forefront. But he called it revenue. For the general public, revenue is different from taxes. And what it all boils down to is it's all about the taxes. The Obamacare thing is about the taxes. Every single thing is about the taxes because the Republicans are fighting taxes tooth and nail, because the people that purchased them, the oligarchs, the wealthy ruling class, they don't want to pay any more taxes. In fact, some of them want to pay less taxes. It's not uncommon to hear some of these radical Republicans saying, yeah, we want to deal with Obama. We want to lower taxes.
Yeah, but Tim, remember, the only deal that was cut that was imperfect not so long ago, a year plus ago, did raise taxes on some very wealthy Americans. It didn't do the so-called Buffett rule that he was looking for, but they got there. And the question is, even though they say they're not going to do anything more on the tax front, if it turns out, in my opinion, if Republicans can shield it in the notion of tax reform, another euphemism for raising taxes, and they get some entitlement concessions, which the president has already said he's willing to do, I think there could be a deal. The question is, did these men and women have the ability to cut a deal on anything? And I just don't know. Tim, thanks for the call.
Well, Mary Beth raises the schmoozing question. And she says, don't forget that Obama invited a bunch of Republicans to the White House for a party to see the movie about the great Republican leader, Abraham Lincoln. And nobody showed up.
Is that true?
Didn't a couple of them show up, Mary? But I could be wrong. But that's the question, I guess, Obama has to deal with. Suppose he has a cocktail party, invites all these Republicans, and none of them come.
Well, you know, Marjorie,
they'll have to eat all the canapes themselves.
The crudités, as you said yesterday. You know, we've mentioned this nonstop, and my apologies, but it's all relevant. We mentioned it yesterday. Chris Matthews was in the studio a few weeks ago writing the story. It could have been called The Schmoozers, the story about Tip and Ronald Reagan. All the Way, which we've discussed ad nauseum, Bryan Cranston's brilliant performance, the American Repertory Theater, now on its way to Broadway, about LBJ, how he got the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in place.
Right.
It was schmoozing. I don't mean
schmoozing. Well, it was also threatening.
But that's part of Lincoln,
schmoozing. In the great movie Lincoln that we just talked about, there was a lot of threatening there, too.
But it's all a function of interpersonal relationships.
Correct.
It's sitting or standing across from the other man and woman, so you can have that schmoozing, that threatening, whatever. And there's got to be more of that. In any case, we're going to obviously stay on top of this in the days and weeks ahead. And as you all know, the next round of this is not that terribly far away, sadly.
Okay, when we come back, it's time for a spy versus spy. How does the real life of CIA operative Valerie Plame compare to the imagined one of CIA spy Vanessa Pearson? Valerie Plame joins us next to talk about her new work of fiction, Blowback. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This week on Innovation Hub, author Douglas Rushkoff sees a future where we spend more of our time creating something of value for each other instead of punching the clock.
So if you only have to work, 10 or 20% of what you used to work, then the fact that there's no jobs stops looking quite as daunting as it did.
I'm Kara Miller. A look into the economy of the future. Tonight at 9 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Atlas Liquors, in business since the end of Prohibition. You can visit Natalie and her brothers in Medford, Quincy, and Roslindale, or you can check Atlas Liquors on Facebook for current offerings of limited releases. And the Massachusetts STEM Summit at Gillette Stadium, November 13th, supported by Massachusetts Business Roundtable and others championing STEM education throughout the state. More at mass-stem-summit.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Is it possible for fiction to surpass real life when it comes to Valerie Plame? She, of course, is the CIA agent whose cover was famously blown during the Bush administration. Joining us in Studio 3 to make the case that it can is Valerie Plame. She's in town for the Boston Book Festival to talk about her debut novel. It's called Blowback. She co-wrote it with suspense writer Sarah Lovett. It's set to be the first in a series of international spy thrillers detailing the work of fictional operative Vanessa Pearson. Valerie, and I think Vanessa, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Look at the smile on her face. Obviously, I'm right.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we'll just double check that because, you know, I'm looking across the studio at you and you are indeed blonde. You are lithe and you are elegant and have an understated sexiness going on there. So are you the character? I can say that because I'm the other woman in the room. Are you the main character in Blowback?
Certainly, Vanessa Pearson is informed by my experiences with the CIA, I would say. But I just got so tired of that whole genre, how females are portrayed in operations. They're usually just afterthoughts, or they're props, or they're just cardboard characters. And I wanted to develop a character that had real depth to her and was much more realistic and didn't just rely on guns and sex. Guns and sex are great.
Guns and sex are always fine. They're always fine. We'll talk about the book in a second because that's why you're here, obviously. But I'm dying to know. I mean, I read about you and you were recruited when you were at Penn State. And I'm dying to know, because you recruited people yourself later on working for the CIA. Why did they pick you, or how did that happen?
I can't go into details of that because the agency has laid down the law that I am not permitted to acknowledge my agency affiliation prior to 2002.
Okay.
But what I can say, I think, is that I come from a family where public service was considered to be something worthwhile. My father fought in World War II in the South Pacific. He was an Air Force officer. My brother served and was wounded in Vietnam as a Marine. My mother was a public school teacher.
Oh, wow.
So when I was given this opportunity, I really jumped at it because it seemed like it was a lot more interesting than what my friends were doing.
And are there many women, I mean, I think of CIA operatives, and this is probably very sexist of me, as men.
No.
I don't think of that, but there are apparently quite a few women.
Well, to my point, exactly, the women that are in popular culture and espionage are just pretty forgettable, except for maybe some of their names of, you know, in the Bond series. But it is still an old boys network in many ways. Just like many organizations in America, there are still obstacles. But I tried to make my success in the CIA going after areas where I could make a difference and I could push forward. That happened to me to be in pursuing nuclear proliferation.
You know, well, I'm listening to you saying to Marjorie what you do, I'm saying, well, the role models we have, other than you, and I think people would put you in this category, there's obviously Homeland and Claire Danes. There's Jessica Chastain and Zero Dark 30, which does
40,
give you...
wasn't it? 40? Was
30, 30.
30.
It does give you a different... Is that a fairly real depiction, either of them, or you're smiling again in an odd way?
I enjoy Claire Danes. She's a great actress. And the first season of Homeland was absolutely riveting. But come on, she is manic depressive. And notice that she doesn't have any friends. Mm. I mean, when your business in human intelligence is to have a really good sense of those around you and to be able to spot, assess, develop, and recruit, which is really the core of what you need to do to collect intelligence, and your only friend is your jazz collection, it's just not – which, again, great TV. It's just not terribly realistic. And from what I understand with Zero Dark Thirty, again, Jessica Chastain, terrific actress. She was nominated for the role. But that character really was a compilation of several, and Furthermore, I know how the movie, because it's so much more dramatic, made it sound like, you know, she was the only one on the case. And in fact, that's not true. There was dozens of people for many years that led to the ultimate takedown of Osama bin Laden.
We're talking to Valerie Plame. Obviously, you know her one way. You'll now know her as the co-author of a great new novel. It's called Blowback. You mentioned Friends, Valerie, a minute ago. And, you know, all of us who are spy watchers as opposed to being in spy agencies saying, what is it like to have to lie to the whole world around you? You said a minute ago to Marjorie, I can't tell you how I whatever. Yeah, and you're not, you can't tell people what you do when you're doing covert stuff. How hard is it to integrate that into your everyday life with people who are close to you, who care about you?
Well, a couple things. First, the CIA recruits people that I think, for the most part, are really mentally strong and have certain characteristics that allow them to maneuver through that world. There is an incredible amount of training that goes into it. But really, it's when you get out there and you're in the field, your cover and your life are very intertwined. It's not one and the other. And personally, I never felt any guilt whatsoever about not being able to tell my friends or whomever where I worked, because a secret is a burden. And why do you want to burden people with that? There's...
But you're carrying the burden. You carry the secret.
Yeah, and that's okay. I loved my job. I was really proud to serve my country. I worked on really interesting things. And that was simply part of the cost of it. Okay.
Yeah. Well, if people don't know this, because this has been written about extensively, and you've written about it too, you spent a lot of the time in the early 2000s looking for the elusive weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Mm-hmm. So, and you've written about this too, that had you had more time, maybe we would not have gone into Iraq.
Exactly. Well, there was clearly a push, and we can have a whole other conversation about what the factors were at play, whether it was a neoconservative ideology and they were an ascendancy, a certain feeling of trying to shore up executive power and so forth. But anyway, my job in the run-up to the war with Iraq was just that, operations, trying to get to the heart of the presumed Iraqi WMD program. Who were the scientists that were really key players? How were they procuring their material? How were they paying for it? What was the state of their nuclear program?
And a lot of these people were cooking the books initially.
On which side?
Well, a lot of people that were saying there were weapons turned out to be exaggerating the situation dramatically.
It's very complex, and you saw definitely a cascade of issues that led to us going to war. But I think it is fair to say that essentially Saddam Hussein took a look around his neighborhood, pretty rough, and realized that he wanted to be the biggest, meanest, baddest dog on the street. And the best way to say is, I have nuclear weapons. And we called his bluff.
So how upsetting to you was it to see the night of shock and awe when we did go over there?
It was deeply upsetting, because I knew from my work, I wasn't privy to everything, but the intelligence was really thin about having, we were told by the Bush administration that the nuclear threat was imminent. We don't want to see the smoking gun in the shape of a mushroom cloud. And I thought that we had moved toward military action with such rapidity that it takes a while to gather real intelligence. And taking a look at then Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech before the UN, where essentially he made the case for war, knowing that his case was much more robust than what I experienced, it was sort of, for me, cognitive dissonance. So I thought we failed. I thought we really failed in terms that if there was WMD and we're going in, we don't know where it is and we don't know how to protect our troops.
You know, it's pretty clear. You said how much you loved your job. It's pretty clear how much you value public service. Talk about your family, that sort of thing. As you walked into the room, Valerie Plame, we just finished a discussion about the shutdown. What's your reaction? I'm laughing at the expression on her face. What's your reaction in the last 16 days?
Like every American, I am absolutely appalled. I want an apology.
From whom?
Everyone involved. $24 billion. You might as well just take a lighter and, you know, have a nice little bonfire with that. It would take a while to burn that much, but
that's
the
alleged loss
to
the economy over the last 16 days, according to Standard & Poor's.
No, I believe deeply in the good that government can do and in public service. And I always encourage young people to consider a career in public service. But when you send your representative to Congress, in fact, to govern, to solve problems and to make it a little better rather than harder, and they don't manage to do that, I haven't heard yet any sort of chagrin from any of our very few of our elected officials that were involved in this debacle.
The equivalent of that apology you're talking about.
Or just, we're sorry it turned out so badly.
That's Valerie Plame. You know her from her history, but you will also know her based upon her new book. It's a novel. It's called Blowback, and she's at the Boston Book Festival.
Can I get back to something you were talking about before, that when people go look in general for people that might be able to do the kind of work that you did, they're looking mm-hmm. at people that are very mentally stable. what else in general? What makes a good CIA agent?
I think one of the most important characteristics has to be a genuine curiosity about other people in the world around you. Everyone has a story, and you just need to find out what that story is. So I think that's important. And as I found out, common sense is actually not that common, an ability to think ahead and
how about fearlessness? That hasn't been on your list so far.
Hey, you know, I'm the mother of 13-year-old twins. That is fearlessness.
No, okay. I'm serious.
way harder than anything
but
else.
But you're being
I had to
falsely
do.
Modest. I mean, that is obviously a huge...
I wouldn't say that adrenaline, some people, he's an adrenaline junkie. That's not what it is. But I certainly knew growing up that corporate America was never appealing to me. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I thought it had something to do with being overseas and doing something beyond the world I knew.
Do your 13-year-old twins think it's cool that mommy was a spy?
I guess so. But generally, they're basically, as children are, really unimpressed by their parents in general, which is why, I have some scrapbooks. So one day when they're more lucid, I can go, see, I actually, did some cool stuff.
Valerie Plame, before we get to your book, and we're going to do that in a couple of minutes, let me ask you about a couple of people and just a very quick reaction. Let's start in the current. The current head of the CIA, John Brennan, what's your take on John Brennan?
Well, he was very much engaged in what we now, enhanced interrogation techniques and so forth. He really is an insider's insider. I've no doubt that he cares deeply about this country, but I was just
What's
speaking.
What's the hesitation you see?
The hesitation is as we, the intelligence world has gotten so vast after 9/11, and I'll lump NSA revelations into that as well. There is no one person that can get their arms around it and really
understand.
Is it
understand. Too big? I mean, my second name was Edward Snowden, so feel free to.
No, it is too big. I was in Washington, D.C. not too long ago, and every time I go, a couple times a year now, I don't live there anymore, but it is booming. The town is booming. The cranes on the sky, the new model cars, the restaurants are full. And this is because, and it's the contractors, billions and billions of dollars that have come into Washington in particular since 9/11. And when you have 60-70%, which is estimated, of the intelligence budget going toward contractors, something is seriously amiss.
Has the intelligence community, whether it's NSA or related, have they crossed the line between protecting us and invading our privacy?
In my mind, yes, particularly as these revelations come out every week and we understand more and more. There always is and will be an appropriate tension between security and privacy. But thus far, what I'm hearing our political leaders say, and a lot of self-important senators say, don't worry, trust us. We are keeping you safe. And now we know that the vast amounts of information that are being vacuumed up by NSA, they have lied to the public on almost every occasion possible when this has been discussed. And I am in complete agreement with President Obama, who said we must have a conversation about this. Yes, we must. And we wouldn't be having that conversation if it were not for Snowden. I think a lot of people expect me to say, oh, that was terrible what he did, and sources and methods being compromised. I can't speak to that. I don't know what happened. nevertheless, this conversation, the issue, Snowden is not important. What is important is the issue.
One last name, Dick Cheney.
Yes.
So, I mean, give me a cliff. Give me a you know, one sentence
something.
Or two on Dick Cheney.
Well, how about I give you something on his daughter, Liz Cheney, who's running for a Senate seat in Wyoming. And I really am watching that with a little smile on my face, because she has spent her entire adult life in Washington. She's moved to Wyoming a year ago and is going after a sitting and established and apparently well-liked Republican
senator. And a family friend, by the way, a friend of the Cheney family.
Well, is that an oxymoron, family friend in the Cheney family? But in any case, she's stepped on every banana peel out there, you know, and I think they should just put up bumper stickers, Liz Cheney, as nice as ever.
That's a good enough answer to the Dick Cheney question. We're talking to Valerie Plame.
Yes. You know, you were very much dissed during this whole thing when the cover was blown and so forth. And people were calling you a desk jockey and an mm-hmm. analyst. And that must have been
the amount of misogyny was quite astonishing. I mean, it was sort of like, oh, she's just a girl.
Exactly.
How could she possibly be doing operations? Sure. And it was, again, the media chose to focus on and the ambassador and his blonde CIA wife rather than the issue, which
is... We're talking about Joe Wilson,
by the way. The husband, the ambassador, and the love of my life. But the issue was, should have been, is this really in our best national security interest to go to war with Iraq? And what's going to happen the day after? The whole war 10 years on was really just an ideological fantasy an attempt to extend our military empire and remake the map of the Middle East. And it was an abject failure.
What do you think about our still being in Afghanistan?
You know, if my son or daughter were serving there, I would be so hard-pressed to understand. I initially, when we first went in, it was, I believe, an appropriate response because that's where the Taliban was.
Yeah.
They were actually the people that attacked us on 9/11, not Iraq. But it is just so painful to see it continue to unfold. And as we read of every week those that are lost there, you go, why?
Can I ask one last thing before
sure.
we get back to the book?
Do whatever you like.
I just wonder, you have written that had your cover not been blown, you would have liked to have continued with the agency
sure.
and gone back in.
Yes.
So what is the career span? Can you like stay as an undercover agent until you're like 65 and retire with your pension? Or is there a life?
Margie wants to know if it's too late for her. So, I mean, everything is about Margie.
Not me. Oh. I am a big chicken. Forget about it. But I mean, I just wondered if you can stay your whole career.
Yeah, my hope was, if none of this had happened, that I would retire as a senior intelligence officer. What happens is, as you go up in seniority, you manage more. Maybe you're not in the street as
right.
much, that sort of thing. But, you know, that was absolutely the plan with my husband and I to go back overseas. And then this sort of all blew up. And I guess there's an unwritten rule that you can't leave Washington until the scandal is over. So that's why it took us a while to move out to New Mexico, where we are now. But obviously my career as a covert operative was done.
Yeah.
You never bumped into Walter White in New Mexico, did you? And I just want to be clear.
Can I say I bumped into Bryan Cranston?
How exciting was
yeah,
that?
Yeah, fabulous. What Breaking Bad has brought to New Mexico and Albuquerque in terms of its economics.
Huge.
And Bryan is wonderful.
We all agree. So let's talk about Vanessa Pearson for a minute, Valerie Plame. What's the deal with the book?
The deal is this. It's the first in a it's a spy thriller. It's the first and hopefully a long series. Vanessa Pearson will continue showing up again. She's a non-official cover officer, meaning that she has no overt affiliation with the U.S. government. And it's wrapped around, the first book anyway, wrapped around a secret Iranian nuclear facility, which as we speak, we know talks are going on mm-hmm. in Geneva on this very issue. And as I said, I tried to make it much more realistic in terms of tradecraft, how it really works, places where she shows up in the book, or places I've lived or worked worked and traveled through. I know them well.
Do you have to submit this manuscript to the CIA?
Did.
You do?
I
because
did.
Of your life?
Yeah.
Everything you've written, you've had to submit, have you not?
I do. Yeah. I guess if I do a cookbook.
Yeah.
So did they...
The CIA cookbook, that'd
be
good.
Did they request or mandate that any part of this manuscript be...
No. It's all about protecting sources and methods, and I completely appreciate that and understand that. So while I submitted it in accordance to the regulations, they did not take exception to anything. They understood that this was fiction. But having said that, I tried to make it realistic.
So you're going to play around the movie or what?
I've been so busy. This has just come out 2 weeks ago, and it's gotten some really nice reviews. So I've been so busy just getting that off the ground. So if you know anyone in Hollywood, just put in a good word for me.
Well,
we'll do our best.
The movie made about you and your husband, Naomi Watts and Sean Penn, were the stars. That was a terrific movie.
Thank you. Fair game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did a great job.
We were proud of it. And it told the story of what happened.
It's been great fun to talk to you. And congratulations on your book. Valerie Plame's new book.
Thank you.
Tell you again, it's Blowback, co-authored with Sarah Lovett. And she's going to be in town for the Boston Book Festival. You can learn more about the Boston Book Festival at bostonbookfest.org. She's going to be there tonight, though, at 7:30. Thank you so much again for being here.
I've never met
a CIA operative before. As far as I know. We wonder about Jim sometimes. Maybe he's slithering around and we don't know about it. When we come back, we're going to talk about the state's decision to scrap its controversial program to curb childhood obesity. That conversation next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Try to hedge your bets in the entertainment industry, but it's not recommended.
The idea that smaller bets are safer is a myth. And what I find is that you really have to swing for the fences if you want to have sustained success in these businesses.
I'm Kai Rizdal, the blockbuster business model, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and AAA Southern New England, helping and serving members for more than 110 years with roadside assistance, insurance and financial products, and a full-service travel agency. Details at AAA.com. AAA, membership for life. And 4 centuries of Massachusetts furniture, where you can see extraordinary furniture made in Massachusetts from the 1600s to the present at museums and cultural institutions throughout the state. Details at 4centuries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. It's probably hard enough to be an overweight kid. I know I was one. Roughly 1/3 of kids are overweight today. But when your school formally acknowledges you have a weight problem by sending you home with a letter with a, quote, required parental notification to alert mom and dad that you're clinically obese, some think it adds insult to injury. This is what Massachusetts has been doing since 2009. Yes. Yesterday, the Department of Public Health, as you probably know, announced they were putting an end to this. Marjorie wrote about it as well. We want to know where you are on this. So you're a parent whose kid received one of these letters. Did it work? Did it make matters worse? If you're a nutritionist or a doctor or a teacher or a nurse, is this a good thing? Or is there a better way to help kids reach a healthy weight? Or is something like this letter better than nothing? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. So you wrote a piece about this morning, basically saying it was a horrible idea.
It was a horrible
good
idea.
Good riddance. Yeah. Why?
Because just the idea of sending home a letter to your house and saying little Megan is obese or little Johnny has a weight problem, it's just there's just something almost visceral. I mean, it's like, oh, this is terrible. If the nurse in school, the teacher in school is worried about your kid, and by the way, obesity is going down in Massachusetts, which is a good thing. Not usually, but a little bit. And we're serving much better food in schools, and people are more aware of, like, we need more recess and more time for these kids to run around. There's just something, and the whole idea of being in school and being taken into a room and weighed and measured.
That's not stopping, you know.
It's not stopping.
They're
but
doing
at least
the weighing
they're not,
and the measuring.
They're doing the weighing and the measuring. I don't frankly like that either. I think it's embarrassing and humiliating to little kids that know they're overweight to begin with. This is have the nurse call mom. Have the nurse call mom. Say, can I talk to you about this? Do it in a way that's not letters going home to every kid in class. You know, the other thing about this, I talked to a mother, a selectman up in North Andover, Tracy Watson, from my Herald column, and her kid got a letter. And as many kids did, the BMIs are very controversial. Lots
Body
of kids
max,
who are very
index,
athletic,
yeah.
who are very muscular, get these letters. And her kid had the self-confidence not to be bothered by it because he's a three-sport athlete. He just won a wrestling championship. But he talked about how many of his kids were, like, devastated. And you see kids the next few weeks, they're not eating their lunches. They become obsessed with their food. This was just a very public way to handle something that is very painful to people.
877-301-8970. I couldn't disagree more, I have to say. While it is true, what Marjorie said is reported today, this is the good news. The percentage of overweight or obese students dropped over the last 5 years, 3.7 percentage points. The bad news is now it's at 30.6%, according to the Mass Department of Public Health. A couple of things, some of which I didn't know and some of which I forgot. One, under the current send a letter home thing, there are two things that are bear noting. If the parent didn't want a letter sent home, you know, all they had to do was bother to go into the school and check off a box saying we're opting out of the program. That's number one. So that would have been a way around it. Number two, reading all the stories, including yours, Marjorie, it seems that the basic problem was because the thing was underfunded. And we'll ask Deval Patrick about this. I think he's with us next Tuesday, but sometime next week when he's here. Because it was underfunded, the original notion was it was to be mailed to the parent. That's far better. Because they ran out of money, they had to stick it in backpacks, which meant other kids saw it and there was bullying. So the solution is suspend it until you fund it. Don't abolish the program. The biggest problem here, and again, I speak to this mm-hmm. as a kid who was an overweight kid. I'd say at least 30% of my youth, I weighed more than I should have, maybe 40%. The problem is, I love my mother to death. I was raised by a single mother. She failed. If she had done her job, we wouldn't have needed the school to get involved.
Jim.
Parents who have a kid who's overweight, which, let me finish this, which not only affects their social situation,
yes.
their learning, probably affects their health and their relationship to the world in later life, because that overweight kid is likely to be an overweight adult. This has got to be fixed, and this was one way to fix
it. Jim, I'm sure your mother was a wonderful woman.
She was.
I've known you for a long time.
Yes.
I don't think you should project your rather unusual experience
on
other people.
Unusual?
Well, why don't you
tell obviously
us
typical.
About the little sandwich your mother made for you every night before
Maybe.
Bed, Jim? I think that's a little bit – what kind of sandwich was it?
It makes my point. Every night before I went to sleep, which is – I mean literally right before I went to sleep. This is really not necessary to disclose, but since you did
– You disclosed it many times.
She would make me a Hebrew National salami sandwich. That was bad. Bad enough, because having that bomb in your stomach when you go to bed is really not that good.
Hebrew National salami.
But she would put a huge slice on top of
That's
the sandwich,
right.
sort of like, you know, like the thing on top of wedding cake or whatever. But by the way, not only does that not disprove my point, it makes my point. My mother, who was a thoughtful, loving person, I was the perfect little boy, even when I was 25 pounds overweight. She didn't know how to deal with this. In fact, she didn't even acknowledge it.
Different time.
A thoughtful letter. Yeah, it's worse now. A thoughtful letter from a school official that is not in a backpack, but that is mailed to a parent, unless they opt out of the system, saying, your kid is overweight. Here's some suggestions. Please come in.
I think a thoughtful call on the telephone would be much better than this. And by the way, this is the same group, the Department of Public Health, which banned bake sales.
Well, that was
they
ridiculous.
Banned
I know it was
bake
ridiculous.
You think that's ridiculous?
Yeah, I do.
Why is that ridiculous, Jim? You're teaching kids that what you do to make money for the schools is fill them up with gooey brownies and cupcakes and all those bad sugary things. Why is that? I mean, that's making them fat, isn't it? You know one of the reasons
I'm against that, too.
You know one of the reasons kids are overweight, too, and it's one of the great ironies. We have become so afraid of letting our children out to play by themselves without mommy without daddy there because we're worried about stranger abduction, which thank God, I mean, it's horrible, but it is extremely rare. We don't send them out and play and say, come home when the street lights come on anymore because your neighbors think you're a bad parent. So we have them there in the house.
You're right.
And particularly if you live, and this is really sad, if you live in some of the dangerous neighborhoods of Boston, there's a lot of mothers who will tell you they won't let their kids out because they're afraid of them getting caught in
that.
Some stray gunfire. I think that's one of the big reasons kids are overweight.
Okay, fine. And our number is 877-301-8970. And by the way, Marjorie, if the phone call home was part of the repeal by this public health board, I'd be fine with it. That's not what they did. They basically said there's no further notification unless you seek the information affirmatively from the school. Let me just read you one more quote, though, and maybe you can explain this to me. It's a piece by Kay Lazar in The Globe talking about those obesity rates in Massachusetts dropping. Here's Carlene Pavlos, who's the director of the Health Department Bureau that runs the school screening program. This is now a trend, meaning the reduction in childhood obesity and overweight. We're working hard to see it continues. Here's the key line. But this is not the time to let up on our strategies and interventions. How does anyone know if this is not part of the reason why the obesity and overweight rate in Massachusetts was going down? It's been in place for the last 4 years. That's roughly the time period over which the overweight rate or the obesity rate of young kids has dropped fairly dramatically. Well, maybe this was contributing to it.
Where does Karlene Pavlos work?
Department of Public Health.
What did they just do last year?
I don't know. What did they do?
Tried to ban bake sales.
Okay.
Ban
so the
brownies,
fact that they may have been wrong or extreme in one case.
Well, I think there's an urge here sometimes for people, well-meaning people, to try to insert themselves into the lives of the citizenry. And lots of people do not like that.
That's fine. But I'm telling you, when a parent, as loving as they are, has not been able to deal with the fact or is in denial about the weight situation of their child,
how many
what?
People do you think have a weight problem themselves or have children with a weight problem who don't know it?
I think my mother, who did not have a weight problem, did not think I had one.
You're projecting your salami sandwich trauma onto
Hebrew
the rest
national
of the
salami
world. Hebrew national salami trauma onto the whole world. And your things, which you've discussed publicly before, about being holed up in your room for like, you know, weeks at a time.
Not weeks. 877. It wasn't
to talk
weeks.
Radio.
301-8970. I was listening to talk radio in its early days. Let's start in Canton with Ryan. We're talking about the decision by this public health group to drop these letters home that assess the weight situation and the health situation of your kid. Hi, Ryan.
How's it going?
Excellent. Thank you for the call.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me. My younger brother came on with one of these letters. He's a physical specimen. The kid doesn't have a pinch of fat in his body. It's just a huge waste of money. But I guess the question is, how can we get parents to stop feeding their kids salami sandwiches before bed without offending anybody?
Well, you. By the way, that is exactly what the question is. I you're laughing as you say
clearly,
it. That is exactly the question.
Mrs. Browdy should have been arrested.
Hey, Ryan, you meant your kid is like the kid that Marjorie described. He's really fit, and because he's got a lot of muscle.
Soccer team.
Yeah. So, but by the way, was he in agony because the letter came home, or did he laugh it off because he knew it was only because of his muscle mass?
He was laughing at it, but I mean, the kids who can't really laugh at it. I mean, like, kids don't need one more thing to be upset about, you know.
Yeah, but Ryan, were you ever overweight as a kid? How old are you?
Oh yeah, I'm 21 now, and I was overweight.
Okay,
about 12 and 15.
If you're, well, so was I. So if it turns out, I don't think most schoolmates of mine needed to see a BMI letter in my backpack to make fun of me. They made fun of me because, sadly, that's what kids do to overweight kids. Is that not a fair statement?
Absolutely.
So the point is, it's the culture. It's not the letter. Isn't what provoked.
I think
the ridicule.
But again,
call, by the way.
You have a tough enough time in the schoolyard with the kids giving you a hard time, and then you arriving at your home on official stationery from the town you live in is a letter telling your mother or father that you're overweight. I mean, it's just piling on.
Did they yesterday authorize that phone call when they repealed this rule from 2009? Whatever this public health group was, did they authorize those phone calls you embraced a minute ago? No. The answer is no. They basically, because there was parental pressure, and by the way, you know how much feed, did you see how many responses, the comments they got to this? 16. A total of 16.
To what?
To this notion that they'd repeal the regulation that's been in place since 2009. However, there's some very loud, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, some outspoken parents who are really upset about it, and they buckled under pressure. The problem has not been solved despite this recent data.
But again, there's been some wonderful developments. Many school systems are serving much more healthy food at lunch. They're getting red, and Peter Katusian, remember he was up at the Health Committee.
Guy just lost the 5th CD Democratic primary.
But to his credit, Peter Katusian, when he was on the health committee up there on Beacon Hill, was big on getting rid of all this junk in the vending machine, so he couldn't be eating ice cream sandwiches and Coca-Colas and all those things, more healthy lunches, expanding. People didn't even think of that. We joked about this a million times. I ate Twinkies every day for lunch. It was terrible. And a Fluffernutter sandwich and a Coca-Cola. It was awful. I mean, my parents, I'm speaking ill of them, it wasn't an emphasis. Now people know those things, even though they still eat the wrong way. They do know
You're
those
kidding,
things.
Right?
Who does
if
not?
If they know them, if they know them and they've internalized it, why do they still feed them to their children?
Because they like them. Because the kids like to eat them. And the parents like to eat them. I don't know that anybody thinks that Cheetos are good for you or Frito, whatever you call those things, are good for you.
How about the Day-Glo Cheetos we talked about last week?
Well,
that's a different story. Okay, let's go
entirely.
To Stephanie.
Eat those by the dozen.
Stephanie in Rhode Island, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call. Hi.
Great, thanks. Yeah, Yeah, nice to talk to you guys. So I just kind of aged out of the public school system within the last, like, 4 or 5 years. And I definitely saw a huge change in the food that, like, the lunches that they produced, and that's great. But I definitely do not agree with sending letters home to tell that your child is overweight. I don't think a parent needs to see that, see it in a letter. And the fact that we're discouraging kids instead of encouraging them is kind of concerning to me.
That's a great point, too.
You mean a positive message as opposed to a negative one.
Yeah, it's like punitive. Yeah. You're absolutely right. That's a great point.
Stephanie, were any of your kids, when they were in school, were any of them overweight?
Are you talking about, like, the kids that I went to school with?
Oh, you said, aged out, you mean you aged out.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so you're another perfect person to talk to, like Ryan a couple of minutes ago. So when a kid was overweight, I assume they were ridiculed because they were overweight, not because there was a letter sent home, right? I mean,
exactly. I mean, this is a time where kids are they need to develop some self-confidence to carry them through life. And if they don't develop it in those, like, in middle school and high school, they're going to be in a lot of trouble down the line. And I think we just keep discouraging this and not encouraging them to feel good about themselves, whether it's, you know, like, stay after school and join the club and play soccer. Like, it builds self-confidence.
Yeah, Stephanie, that's a good call. I have to say, it's a good call. Thank you very much for joining us.
You know, it's one of the things that is always terrible, and you see it a lot where parents do have, particularly girls, that have weight problems, and they're having them on diets at really early ages, and you just feel terrible.
Horrible.
But again, you know, they do have significant weight problems. The mother's instinct is right. But then you get all screwed up about eating disorders and all these things.
You know what part of our team, Chelsea, mentioned this morning, and I hadn't thought of it until she said it, and then it just popped back into my mind. Our home ec discussion we had, was that yesterday, the day before,
whatever
it was, bring back home ec, and both of us agreed on that. It's in part, kids don't know how to make food. Most kids, even though maybe in one part of their brain know what's healthy, don't know what's not. We are in an era, and this was not the case when you and I were kids. Things that were, quote, healthy when we were young, would you agree, taste horrible? They did. There is healthy stuff now in restaurants, in Whole Foods, in the generic Whole Foods markets, that is as spectacular as the horrible crap that you and I grew up on, including that wonderful Hebrew National sandwich.
Yeah, the Dinty Moore's beef stew wasn't really the right thing.
You
to
only grew up
dinner.
On, by the way, can I tell you something? And I've told you this. A broadcast beef stew out of a can. It's because my mother was working 3 jobs. Don't be angry.
Well, that's
her.
Another reason.
Broadcast corned beef hash, which
really?
I'd mix with corn niblets.
Pretty good, though,
that
wasn't
was
it?
Fabulous. If you put it in a thing and really get it nice and hot. And the third
thing. Fry it up.
I knew how to boil a hot dog. Those were essentially the 3 staples in my diet when I was people, our producers in the other room, were making faces
poor
and holding their heads in their
jumbo
hands.
Jumbo Jim.
But I wasn't jumbo. I was jumbo, which is why I think I have a perspective on this that's valuable. I think this health group essentially just panicked in the face of criticism from some outspoken parents. And again, if the parent didn't like it, Marjorie, I wasn't aware of this till today. All they had to do was go to school and opt out of the program, and no letter would come home either in the mail or the backpack.
Or maybe the state bureaucrats lost their confidence themselves when they were battered about the nanny state going berserk when they tried to ban this bake sale, Jim.
You know, I want Deval Patrick has admitted to us, and he'll be here next week, that he was overweight for a decent part of his childhood, too. I'm really dying to see. Well, I assume they wouldn't have done this if he wasn't bought into the repeal of the regulation, but I'm dying to hear what he has to say.
Well, he said he was never opposed to bake sales.
He did say that?
Yes, he did say that.
You interviewed him about that? One of the hot issues?
I did my research yesterday.
I'm sure you did.
And he said he was not opposed to bake sales.
Heather, you're in Arlington. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi. So when I was in high school, I'm 23, so it wasn't too long ago, they had this way of testing kids called the fitness test.
Yep.
Have you ever heard of it?
Yep. We had a variation on the theme when we were in school. Pull-ups, that sort of,
And it's horrible. It's humiliating. And what they would make us do is run sprints, and they do it almost like a metronome. So you have to be able to make it in enough time, and the kids who were overweight or not in shape would fail and just be stood out in front of the class pretty much for not being in shape, or we'd have to do sit-ups or push-ups or whatever. And I just don't understand the point of that. It's like, these kids know already. I don't know why you need to point them out in front of the class pretty much.
But let's assume there even wasn't the testing, Heather. You still believe there should be physical fitness stuff in schools. I don't know if you're aware, in Massachusetts, it's one of the great incredible oxymoronic, well, it's not oxymoronic, it's a poor choice of words. I don't know what it is. We mandate a physical education in our schools, but we don't mandate how much time you have to devote to it, which means that essentially there's no physical education in most public schools in Massachusetts. You're not against phys ed, I assume. You're just against these tests, which expose out-of-shape kids to be what they are.
Exactly, because these kids need to like gym. They should be excited to go
to gym.
That's
another good point.
They're going to gym and they're being humiliated.
Well,
you're right. That's the part of this, I guess, that so bothers me. It's like a further humiliation of someone who's already not feeling great about
themselves.
Should
they not weigh the kid like that? Now they're doing, even with the repeal,
they should weigh them. In school. I don't.
Even in a closed room, which is what the nurse is now doing.
Everybody knows what you're doing. You're going in there to get
weighed.
They're
doing it with every kid. They're not just pulling the fat kids out.
I know that, but if you are overweight to begin with, you're very self-conscious. Conscious about it, and everybody knows that little Susie, who's 10 pounds overweight, or little Jimmy, whoever it is going in there and getting weighed, and oh boy, it must be awful to be her because she's going to come out of there and she's going to weigh 220 pounds.
It was horrible when I was weighed one of those years. They made me put down the salami sandwich because I had not finished it. No, that's really not. It's not totally true. It's close to true. John in the car, you're on with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking about the decision yesterday to repeal this 2009 regulation that mandated that these letters go home advising parents about their kids' weight, height, BMI, that sort of thing. Hey there, John.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
I actually didn't mind the letters at all. And I think it's a good example of how the media often tries to pick up on the most controversial part. I mean, this was a whole program of stuff that the state rolled out several years ago.
Yes, it was.
One part of it.
It's a good point.
And I think the big story was that the Massachusetts actually moved the needle on childhood obesity.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
You know, and you hear, but Marjorie, you drive me crazy when you talk about the good thing that schools are taking out. You know, the vending machines and stuff like that. But in the same breath, you'll bemoan the fact that, you know, they wanted to get bake sales not put in the schools. And the reason for that is it's called, in the public health world, it's called competitive food environments. And if you're a kid in a poorer community, you get about half of your calories per day in school. And so from a public health perspective, what they're really trying to do is change the environment by which kids get most of their calories during the day. And so I applaud the public health people in Massachusetts for trying something, for risking failure on something, but ultimately it's a success, and I think that we should be applauding them.
I also think, John,
the bake sales are not there every day, obviously, but, you know, it's learning how to eat, and I think there's nothing wrong, even if you've got a weight problem, with having the occasional cookie or the cupcake or whatever it is. It's a nice sweet at the end of the meal. I mean, I think we have a problem about eating and stopping.
But John, thanks for a great call. But if it turns out there is a totally edible, delicious alternative, and it begins to get people, kids realizing, as you said, with Peter Katujan's vending machine alternatives when he was a state rep, that there are alternatives that not only make you healthier, but much more importantly, actually taste good. That's a terrific forum in which to learn that.
Or you just sell something else. Instead of the bake sale, it's the jewelry sale, or it's the Christmas card sale, or something like that that isn't even about food. You know, we just got an email from Maddie saying that her friend got one of these letters from her daughter. The dad's family is a big family. Now this little girl asked her mom if the outfit she's wearing makes her look fat, and she's 10.
One of the best scenes, horrible scenes and great scenes in one of the best movies of all time. You've seen Little Miss Sunshine, I assume. When the father at the tells the kid what she should not eat at the table when they're all there in the restaurant, and they all surround her, Olive, and show her how they love her in the face of this clueless father, it's fabulous. In any case, we should end with the good news. The good news is what we started with, even though Marjorie and I disagree on the solution here. The report that came out in the last 24 hours, newly released data, over the last 5 years, the percentage of overweight or obese students has dropped in Massachusetts, 3.7 percentage points, down to 30.6, reported by Kay Lazar in the Globe. It's good. It's not good enough.
That's right.
I think this was a decent part, as John said a minute ago, of the mix of things this public health group was doing. And I think they just buckled under pressure, frankly, and I wish they hadn't.
And had Mrs. Browdy to do it all over again, she would not have stuffed you with those Hebrew National salami sandwiches every night.
We didn't call it stuffing at the. we called it eating. Late night eating is what we call it in my particular house. But thank you, Marjorie.
You're welcome.
Reminding me of that.
Earlier, we were talking with former CIA operative Valerie Plame. When we come back, Christopher Lydon joins us to go over how the CIA became the operation that Valerie Plame was part of. Chris's take is that the CIA and UN foreign policy as we know it could be coming to an end and taking American exceptionalism with it. Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH.
I'm Marco Werman. The budget crisis sure has not helped America's image.
The general sentiment in Europe is this is crazy political theater. How is it possible that 24, 25 Tea Party Republicans have so much power in this big, big U.S. Congress?
We'll keep you covered with the latest news from Washington and hear how America's fiscal crisis has been playing out around the globe. That's on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and S&H Construction, specializing in residential renovations, custom building, historic restorations, renewable energy, site work solutions, and remodeling. S&H, quality, integrity, and value. shconstruction.com. And Great Performances, 40th Anniversary Celebration. Itzhak Perlman, Josh Groban, and more perform to honor the program's 40 years on public television. Watch Great Performances Friday at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And last week, Christopher Lydon was weightless. He was buoyed by the film Gravity and the reassuring things the movie has to say about humanity. This week, Christopher Lydon brings us a different message of optimism by way of an unlikely duo, the brothers Dulles, John Foster Dulles. He was the Eisenhower-era Secretary of State. Alan Dulles, his brother, the Eisenhower-era director of the CIA. They're the founding brothers of American exceptionalism, an institution that could be cracking, could be giving way to what some are calling humanism. Here to lead us on that tour from the Dulles Brothers to 2013 is Christopher Lydon. Hey, Chris.
Greetings, Jim. Greetings, Marjorie. Ever the optimist, Chris Lydon, that seems to me my billing. I want to get this out of the way. I never had a childhood obesity problem.
My mother was
True. My mother was a health food nut. We used to sing to her, Blackstrap molasses and wheat germ bread make you live so long you wish you were dead. But we were skinny, skinny, skinny.
Any of the Lydon siblings were, was there an issue anywhere in the household?
Not an ounce of fat on any of us, even to this day.
So wait a second, let me just be clear, even though this wasn't our topic.
We got to get to the CIA.
Your mother never made you a Hebrew National salami on white bread with mustard with a little piece of extra salami on
top
at
bedtime?
My mother
didn't think food was supposed to taste good. There wasn't supposed to be much of it. You know, get back to your homework.
Did you get to have
Irish Puritanism all the way.
Did you get to have a chocolate chip cookie at least?
Nah, she didn't like sugar highs.
Oh, my goodness.
No, it was strictly, you know.
Corned beef and cabbage.
Christopher Lydon, brothers. Tell us about
the Dulles. I want to revert to Valerie Plame.
Oh, sure.
I mean, she was fascinating on the CIA thread, but I want to talk about another book. There's a Boston Book Festival connection. But it just clicked for me in so many ways, I just thought it was worth mentioning. And it ties together a lot of the conversations, actually, we've had over 6 or 8 months. I mean, this is Steve Kinzer's polemical double biography of the Dulles brothers, John Foster Dulles, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles, who ran the CIA sort of in its heyday when I was a lad. They ran the empire and, in a sense, the world in the 1950s. More amazing, in a sense, their muscular corporate Presbyterian instincts and their doctrines ran the government for 50 years after they died. And more amazing still, In this strange sort of kaleidoscope of 2013, the Dulles brothers' era of United States firepower and global power seems to be coming apart. I love this book called The Brothers. Steve Kinzer is one of those writers who gives you sort of, through the day-to-day chaos, a flash of coherence.
Former Globe, former New York Times
yes.
reporter.
Yeah, I used to call him Mike Dukakis' Mike Dukakis. He wrote for a Brookline child, eternal Celtics fan, and a terrific guy. He's got a real record now of these independent books, including the CIA takeover of Iran in the early 50s, which is part of, I mean, he wrote that probably 10 years ago. But he has really called an important turn here. But anyway, I link it to almost everything, including the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, the retreat from Afghanistan, the comeuppance around Iraq, the meltdown, the showdown, that all this NSA spying, the self-sacrifice of Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, and the journalism that's bringing all of this up. But I include also, you know, the new Pope. I include the Nobel for Alice Munro. I include that movie Gravity we were talking about. There are these little buds of a new humanism coming up through the cracks of the Cold War, the Cold Military.
Well, and the American public's reaction to the potential bombing of Syria
Absolutely.
Is the ultimate manifestation.
But
can we go back to the beginning?
Expand the Dulles brothers a minute, because I'm sure lots of people, as I am, are not aware of their whole.
You children, we have to explain the nightmare history that the rest of us grew up in.
They're going from country to country to country and saying, "Get rid of these."
Well,
people.
Even go further back. Start with the story
Short
of
form.
One of the Dulles brothers who's in a law firm.
That's a great story.
One
the
of his clients'
lawyer in America.
Interests is threatened by a new leader of another nation. He gets on a train to go to Washington.
Yeah.
And what happens there?
Well, these guys, first of all, I mean, they were children of privilege, you could say. Their grandfather had been Secretary of State in the Benjamin Harrison era. They grew up, all the perks of money and prestige. Princeton, and it's a relief that some of these war criminals didn't come from Yale. A few of them didn't come from Yale. But in any event, they were associated with the firm Sullivan and Cromwell, still a huge power on Wall Street. But John Foster Dulles was the highest paid lawyer in America in the 30s. They represented everybody in the corporate establishment, including United Fruit and the Rockefellers and Big Oil. And Alan Dulles, meantime, had a whiff of spy duty at the end of World War I. He also was in Sullivan and Cromwell, but between them, they had private power, they had covert power, they had the sort of majesty of government power when they wanted it. And when Dwight D. Eisenhower became president, they represented the United States in the world. They also stood for this kind of, you speak of exceptionalism, Jim, but a virtual family doctrine. As Andrew Bacevich has said, a vision of a world run from Washington by people like themselves. We remember peace and prosperity in the 50s, the mark of the Eisenhower. But in fact, as Kinzer reminds you, it was a period of covert war, proxy war, and continual war, but all sort of a parody of the John Quincy Adams line about the United States.
But wait. You can say whatever you want, but I just want to fill in the blanks on just this one. Before John Foster Dulles was the huge, most powerful lawyer at Sullivan Cromwell, he's in his 20s, according to Steve Kinzer. One of the partners calls him and says, there's a problem in Cuba. There's been an election. The liberals, who don't like American corporate power in Cuba, have taken over. So the 20-something John Foster Dulles gets on a train, goes to D.C., goes to see his uncle, who, as you said, was then the Secretary of State, and they send two warships into Cuba. That's the beginning of our whole Castro thing, because a corporate client of Sullivan and Cromwell was threatened.
It happens with astonishing regularity in this story. I mean, corporate clients to begin with, and then perfect access, walk in the door to high power in the United States, and then a complete cold-blooded investment in dirty tricks and covert operations. And it's repeated over and over again. I was just going to quote the line that we all love out of 19th century John Quincy Adams saying that the United States goes not abroad in search of monsters. But that was exactly what the Dulles brothers did over and over again. It began in Iran or Guatemala, both similar kinds of things. In Iran, of course, it was oil. This is early 50s. Coming out of World War II, they had a very promising young democracy, this guy Mohammad Mossadegh. Parliamentary elections, he had Western education, he was a lawyer and a Democrat, but he was dedicated to taking control of Iranian oil back from the Brits. Churchill was upset. Truman said, tough luck, it's a new world. But as soon as Eisenhower came in, the Dulles brothers set about destabilizing Mossadegh and installing the Shah. And the rest is everything that follows, original sin. I mean,
In great part because part of their client base, as you said before, were huge oil companies who were not crazy about this new Iranian leader, correct?
Well, exactly. And never a question, as far as we know, about conflict of interest. The scare word in Iran in the 50s was that the Soviets had designs on Iran and on the Gulf. It's very, very hard to say that the Dulles brothers didn't kind of manufacture this hysteria, but they sent Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, in with about $1 million in cash, and it was the model of what we still do today have done till lately in Afghanistan and Iraq, turned the place over, stirred up mobs, paid rabble-rousers to scare the country out of its wits, scare the Mossadegh into house arrest and then exile, and the Shah in. 25 years of the Shah and his secret police and tortures and whatnot, we have the Mullah regime that we're still kind of at odds with. But this pattern of seeking monsters, stirring up an anti-communist fear, destabilizing, regime change, overthrow, went from Iran to Guatemala. It sort of took root also in the villainizing of Ho Chi Minh. Remember, Ho Chi Minh was relying on Franklin Delano Roosevelt's promise to help get rid of the French after World War II. In come the Dulles brothers, and they say, we won't hold those promised elections in Vietnam in 1954, which would surely have been won by Ho Chi Minh. But then again, the same thing happens in the Congo, in Patrice Lumumba, who is remembered still as the man who might have heralded an entirely different course of African history than Cuba. Are we up to six? Well, and then there's also Indonesia. The Dulles brothers didn't like the fact that Sukarno, the president of Indonesia, was a neutralist between the Soviet Union and the West, and they declared war on him too. Led to horrific, horrific massacres at the United States' behest.
You know, you mentioned Andrew Bacevich a minute ago. We had him on, or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah, good man.
Shortly after he did an op-ed, and to demonstrate that what the Dulleses wrought was then continued over decades, he writes in this op-ed in the Globe, he's talking about the Middle East in this case, not those six countries. The upheaval enveloping so much of the Islamic world today exposes that assumption that we can control destinies is a vast illusion. Whatever the forces transforming that world before our eyes, Washington probably can't decipher them, and certainly can't direct them. He is essentially telling a variation on the exact same story of what the Dulles brothers were doing in the 1950s. If you want to be part of this conversation with Christopher Lydon, by the way, you can call us 877-301-8970.
Well, we do have a call. Let's take Paul from Milton. He's got a great question for you, Christopher Lydon.
Hey, Paul. Go for it, Paul.
Go ahead.
Hi,
Paul.
How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. I'll get right to the point. There's a third brother, and I'm named Avery Dulles, who was a Jesuit either at Fordham or at Georgetown.
Actually, a son, I think, Paul.
I just looked up. He was the youngest brother, I think, of John Foster.
I think he's John Foster's son, but I could be wrong.
Okay, I could be. Well, all right. He died at 90 in 2008, so my math is I was an English major.
how does the Jesuit fit into this
played a role between in Vietnam, or at least getting us involved, maybe through his father or uncle's connection, then
our producers just looked it up.
He's the son of Alan. He's the son of Foster Dulles.
Yeah,
son of Foster Dulles. Okay, it did say he grew up in a Presbyterian family, and I guess he converted to Catholicism. But I thought there was a connection between Avery Dulles, John Foster Dulles' son. I sit corrected. That Cardinal Spellman, who was originally from Whitman, played an integral part in getting either Avery Dulles' ear and then to his brothers to protect the Catholics.
I think that's only half right, if that. He was the son of Foster Dulles. He was a Jesuit and a writer, a theologian. I don't think he had anything to do with Vietnam. Cardinal Spellman, of course, did. I mean, he was one of the principals who convinced the United States that Vietnam was a Catholic country, which it wasn't, not even remotely. But I think Avery Dulles had an independent career. I don't believe he was entangled in their politics. But you are half right. Maybe I'm half wrong. Onward.
Thank you for the call, Paul.
You know, also, Kinzer makes this point. It was the only time in American history that siblings controlled both the overt and covert sides of American foreign policy.
I'm not quite done with that,
Why is that?
Because there were the Bundy brothers from Cambridge and the North Shore of Boston. I mean, McGeorge Bundy was the National Security Advisor under Kennedy. His brother, Bill Bundy, was very high in the CIA ranks. I mean, they had the world surrounded then. I remember it mainly by Jimmy Breslin's marvelous line at a Harvard class day. I think it was 1970, but he said, "I'll tell you what's wrong with the world. The Berrigan brothers are in jail and the Bundy brothers are on the street."
Oh,
that's a
great
pretty
line.
Good Breslin imitation.
That's a great line. So is this one of the major dammings of these brothers, or has this been have other people gone the same route before?
Pete, there have been lots of books about the Dulleses, especially back in the day, but this is the first unshirted attack that I think puts the whole thing in perspective. And that's what Steve Kinzer's for. I hadn't seen it that clearly. There's one important linchpin that's left out, actually, this story. Alan Dulles's last strike was the Bay of Pigs invasion. That was his invention, executed by his guys, not quite ready for the end of the Eisenhower administration. It was inflicted on the Kennedy administration. Kennedy said, okay, you say it'll work, but we're not coming in to rescue anybody. And they didn't. It was a fiasco. There was no uprising in Cuba. The volunteers were completely ill-equipped for the moment. Kennedy was outraged, embarrassed. He felt he'd been trapped, and he'd been seduced by the CIA on the expectation that, of course, when one of our projects got in trouble, we would send in the Navy or air cover or whatever, and he refused. It was war with Alan Dulles ever since. He fired Alan Dulles. The CIA that rank of the CIA was outraged. Kinzer does not even go near the question of whether Alan Dulles had a hand in what could have been a rogue or CIA, maneuver against Kennedy. He does say that Alan...
Maneuver meaning that led to his execution.
Alan Dulles had his last revenge, or that his people did. What he does say is that Lyndon Johnson very curiously put Alan Dulles on the Warren Commission, that Alan Dulles actually ran the Warren Commission. He instructed the commission lawyers on how to interrogate the CIA, and he instructed the CIA on how to answer the Warren Commission's questions. This is a very, very ugly thing. Kinzer knows full well the JFK movie guy,
Oliver Stone,
he believes and says out loud that Alan Dulles was behind the murder of John F. Kennedy. But again, who can prove that? Except that, for me, in the general mythology we all carry around of the history of the world in our lifetimes, it's all part of that moment that broke 50 years ago this fall. And when Kennedy, as I understand it, was making a big turn. I mean, Kennedy said he wanted to splinter the CIA and scatter it to the four winds. He was cutting the budget 20% per year in the years ahead after the Bay of Pigs. But we have there a moment when the CIA had led the country into terrific problems. Kennedy was aware of it, and suddenly Kennedy is gone. And that power, that unbelievable power of corporations, covert action, and American military power, took over. The good news, we can't leave this out, is that Kinzer was talking about this book. He said, since he wrote this book, the world has changed.
Well, let's get to that. Where does the Pope fit into this? The new Pope Francis that many Catholics have been swooning over since
including you.
Including me, that's right.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, where does the Pope fit into this thing?
Well, he fits in this sense. For one thing, he was vocal against the yet another American swatting in the Middle East in the moment of Syria.
Yep.
In August. He, as well as the EU and the British Parliament and the Secretary General of the UN and Vladimir Putin and everybody else. But the Pope was in there. But to me, I look around the world desperate for good news, looking for little buds of a humanistic understanding, and I see this Pope as an unbelievable fulfillment. I mean, for that man to say, let's get over this obsession with sex.
Yes.
I mean, hello, I wish you'd been there in my boyhood, guy. but this is, could we be Christians too? Could we be loving human beings? I also want to, I mean, to me, the Nobel for Alice Munro, who is about nothing if not, as she says, people in one small corner of Ontario, handicapped people, broken people, hurt people, triumphant people, happy people, married people, you know, hurting people, is another sort of little signal of what I'm looking for. But the main things, of course, are in our public life. I mean, these trials and I don't know what to make of this war over the mind of Barack Obama, but there he was on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington saying, oh, by the way, tomorrow we go after Syria. And then suddenly, I mean, he was obviously on the edge about it, but suddenly he turns. He said, wait a sec, after the British Parliament voted, he said, maybe we ought to take this to Congress.
For whatever it's worth, Chris, the same reason why this pathetic maneuver by the Republicans collapsed was Lindsey Graham saying last night on the steps, on the lawn outside Capitol Hill, as we heard 75% of the people, American people, are contempt for us. Same reason, in my estimation, why the president and ultimately backed down on Syria. The people rose up at least those two times.
Yes, another incredibly hopeful sign. I mean, but you can also see, I agree with every word you spoke, Jim, but I also see this whole shutdown thing as a kind of mental breakdown surrounding this huge turn in the ship of our governance. I mean, there are John Boehner looks like nothing if not a kind of the last of the 50s Republicans.
Yeah.
Let's take one more call before you go, Chris. Sure. Dan from Worcester, you're bringing another family into the discussion, which I think is worth doing. Dan, good morning. Good afternoon. Hello.
Good afternoon, Jim, Marjorie, Chris.
Hey, Ben.
Just want to say that this family, these attorneys that we're talking about from the 30s, family life and their attitudes parallel the Fitzgerald Kennedys, in my estimation. I know you're not going to agree with that, but they were movers and shakers who moved things in the world and for the United States and for their own interests. And I think that the Kennedys did the same thing.
Let Chris respond to that.
Interestingly similar and different. And John Foster Dulles was an incredible Puritan, married to one woman all his life. Alan Dulles was a kind of almost Kennedy-esque, roving eye ladies' man, and a kind of libertine, loved his sensual life and his secret life. The Kennedy question, the connection is tough. They're very different kinds of powerful, overwrought, larger than life people. But I never felt the sense of Kennedy's serving clients or in it for their own, you know, financial aggrandizement. Do you, Dan?
You have to admit that the Kennedys and this other family, their politics, in your estimation, I would believe. Were different. However, they used the same means to accomplish whatever it is, whatever tasks they felt that they had to accomplish. They used their power and influence to do that. So if we're going to call power and influence a bad thing, or maybe not, but if just for the sake of this conversation, then they're both guilty of that.
Well, the question is, what do you use your power and influence for?
Yeah,
Dan, thank you for the call.
These are people that were doing a lot of the bidding of the corporations that they represented. But one thing before we leave about the Pope, I think one of the great things about the Pope is the outreach to Muslims. Remember, Benedict, his predecessor, was so nasty toward Muslims. And the Pope being so conciliatory and talking about the similarities and talking about the mention of Christ in the Quran and all that. And also talking about, you know, the line, you know, the culture of comfort and this great piece in the Washington Post that we were reading this morning, the globalization of indifference, all these things about the poor. And I just find it so uplifting because you haven't heard much poor talk from popes lately or certainly much outreach to Muslims.
Well said. I couldn't improve on that, except to say I loved him from the moment he chose the name Francis as his papal name, Marjorie. I mean, to identify with the saint of nature, the saint of birds, the saint of kindness, the saint of, you know, the famous prayer, O Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. I mean, that was a brilliant start.
Yeah, that was a brilliant start, and that was a great prayer, too. Christopher Lydon, always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for being with us. Chris is with us every Thursday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic, of course. And you can keep up with him 24/7 at radioopensource.org. When we come back, Karen Miller talks to us about the blockbuster film and how that business model is spilling over into other industries and spawning the blockbuster book, the blockbuster song. And great news for superstars, but bad news for independent artists. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Once upon a time, being Treasury Secretary was a quiet Washington job for an economic wizard and Washington power figure.
I never lived through a time like this. I must say it's scandalous.
The times former Treasury Secretary Michael Blumenthal has lived through would fill more than a book. From the Holocaust to the circus of 2013, the wisdom of an eyewitness to history. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis, performing Abyssinian, a gospel celebration, Sunday, October 27th at Symphony Hall. More at celebrityseries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. The notion of the blockbuster no longer belongs exclusively to the movie industry. It's a business model that's also affecting television, publishing, music. Joining us to talk about what this means for business, for culture, and most importantly, for you, is Kara Miller. She's the host of the Innovation Hub. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
Thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
So this does not sound like a good thing, this blockbuster takeover.
It depends on what you're into. So, you know, I think that it's a fascinating thing because if you dial the clock back, let's say 5-10 years ago, and people really were starting to see the rise of social media, the rise of Netflix and YouTube, YouTube now owned by Google and bought by them for a heck of a lot of money. And I think the original thinking was, the great thing about these technologies is they allow a multiplicity
Absolutely.
Of channels, right? So you're into, you know, whatever you're into, folk music, reggae, whatever it is you're into, you have a place. Whereas it used to be that there were three networks and Walter Cronkite said, that's the way it is, and the end, like we were done. It turns out that the blockbuster, instead of sort of dying, has actually gained a whole new life. So if you look, for example, this is a fascinating statistic. Nielsen, you know, the guys who do the TV yep. ratings and everything, they said 8 million different songs or spoken word, you know, unique sounds were sold in 2011, okay? 94% of them, 94% of those 8 million that were sold under 100 copies. So that means almost all of us actually, as it turns out, want exactly the same things. Right. We all want to go to Iron Man 1 and 2 and 3 and see The Hangover. I don't know what we're up to on The Hangover now. I think 3. But, you know, I mean, don't worry. It'll keep going.
But isn't that the question, though? You stated that as fact, that that's what we want. Isn't it the chicken and the egg question here? Are the blockbusters, whether they're the music stars as opposed to the independents, whether they're the Iron Man 3 or Once, for example, one of the greatest movies of all time, a small little independent thing, is it what we want or is it what they convince us that is the best stuff out there and we buy it because it's merchandise so brilliantly?
So my argument, I should say, is building on the work of Anita Elbersee, a wonderful professor who has actually written a book called Blockbuster. She is at Harvard Business School. And I do not think it's a chicken or an egg situation, and I think she would say the same. I think what we're really looking at is a situation in which YouTube originally thought, this is great, we're going to provide channels for all this niche stuff because, you know, there's people into all sorts of things. And it turned out that what people really wanted was to listen to Jay-Z's YouTube channel, and he has his own and he programs mm-hmm. it. And so, no, I think that there were places, Netflix, they were prepared to be the place that brought you the indie films and the Bollywood and, you know, all this, you know, documentary stuff, all these things that you couldn't find at your local Cineplex. But it turned out that people wanted what was at the Cineplex. And if they didn't, if they were sort of maybe a little bit older than that, you know what they wanted? They wanted House of Cards starring Kevin Spacey. Huge production value, right? Big name director. You know, so people don't, as it turns out, want the fringes that much. That's why they're the fringes.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Do you agree with that? That essentially they're giving us the blockbusters. Again, whether it's in music, that's a stunning statistic. That
94%
that is really
sold
stunning.
Under 100 copies. 32% of them sold one copy. Wow. One. It's got to be you, your mom, somebody.
I think that was one of my covers of a Michael Jackson tune. It hurts my head to think that you're right, that essentially all we want are, I mean, obviously what people like me would say was Lone Ranger was an unmitigated disaster, but I think she explains that away, is it's an outlier. No one even remembers the Lone Ranger. So it was a harder sell despite Johnny Depp's involvement. But the notion that all we want are these limited choices with huge investments, whether it's the Lady Gagas, who I happen to love, or the Iron Man 3, which
I
actually
like
is pretty
Gaga
good.
I like Lady Gaga, too.
But it's a frightening notion to me that we're getting exactly what we want, which is what you and this woman believe.
I mean, so, you know, it depends on who you mean by we. So first of all, the people who spend the most money at the movies are under 25.
That's a very good point.
Right? So
That's
you can complain
point.
All you want That's about how awful The Hangover is, but if you're not spending your money at the movies, they are not making movies for you. I mean, the end. That's one thing that's happening. And I have to say, as you said, The Lone Ranger, huge flop. Probably going to waste something on the – they're probably going to lose something on the order of $200 million
yeah,
on The Lone Ranger.
Money.
But – so look at the experiment of betting on the blockbuster. Warner Brothers – look at their 10 most expensive movies, okay? They ate up 30% of their budget. Why? Because they got the Johnny Depps and the Tom Cruise and the Brad Pitts, and they say, you know, we command a lot of money. Okay, 10% of their movies ate up 30% of their budgets. They're also 50% of their earnings. So even though you've got Johnny Depp saying, I'm just going to make a ton of money on this movie, he's still worth it. And that's another thing that I think we should get to, which is the power of the star as mogul.
But, you know, some part of this has got to be that we want what we know about. Because you know about Iron Man 3, because you see the billboards everywhere. And if you go to the movies, it's in the trailers and all that, the previews. And you know about these certain stars. I mean, I'm always amazed by I just said this between segments, how much I don't know about. And you know, you can't find out everything. So the things that get advertised
You're making my point exactly that Kara dismisses. And
I
that
know.
Apparently this woman dismisses that it's essentially because they've marketed the blockbusters so brilliantly. And that's where they want us to go. But her research suggests that's not. I mean, for example, if a studio decides today, I'll spend $300 million or whatever on one film that's got these huge stars that's part of a comic book series that everybody loves, instead of on 10 films at $30 million each. That's essentially their philosophy, correct?
Yeah, and it pays off, too.
Because
but look at in the book market, where you see people like Bill O'Reilly, who's a famous guy because he's got a big TV show on Fox News. His books are not, you know, we're not talking Hemingway here.
I don't know. Bill O'Reilly would dispute that.
Well, that also makes Kara, you're making Kara's point there, though. Bill O'Reilly is the perfect blockbuster example.
He's a blockbuster.
I don't think Bill O'Reilly would say he's a fabulous writer.
Why do you think people are buying his books?
Okay, good question. We have a clip from Bill O'Reilly answering that very question.
Perfect.
Let's listen.
Of course it's sensationalist. That's who I am. I'm a sensationalist. I'm a big mouth. I get attention. In this world, you have to, if you want a mass market presentation, you have to get attention.
He's a blockbuster.
Yeah,
I mean, he is the ultimate human blockbuster.
But why are people buying his books?
Because
they've seen him on TV.
Exactly.
And he's written books for kids, I think, which have been top, you know, bestsellers on the nonfiction list. He makes over $10 million a year just for doing his TV show. That's not talking about other contracts he's got, how much he can get paid for a speaking fee, which I would guess would be between $50,000 and $100,000 per speech. But the interesting thing about Bill O'Reilly is, oh my God, you think, wow, what? He's so overpaid. How is that possible? You know how much Fox News made last year in profit? Close to $1 billion. So the thing is, he makes a lot because he's worth it. And he knows it, and his agent know it. And then that's sort of the trickle-down effect. That's what the Jay-Z's and the Julia Roberts and the Angelina Jolie's, that's what they all know. They know they've got leverage because you need them.
Okay, so before we get to the calls, and we will in about a minute, at 877-301-8970, is Kara right? And is this, what's the woman's name again?
Anita Alberci from Harvard Business
School. Is Alberci right that essentially they are giving you, all these industries, what you want? What is the research that suggests that Marjorie and I aren't right, that the reason we're drawn to all these blockbusters is because it's brilliant marketing? It's not what we really – we want to go to the Kendall Theater and see an independent film with four other people in there more than we want to go see Rocky 13. I mean, what's the data that suggests she's right?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple things. One is people like shared experiences, and no matter how many lines of different spokes on the wheel you have from YouTube, and people can get in their own little niche, people like coming in and saying, did you watch Breaking Bad?
You're
people
right.
like doing that. That is like a shared communal experience. Well, another thing that's happening too, you talked before about the we, you know, what do we want? A lot, increasingly, who we are people in China and Russia and places where, couple things. One is English is not the first language, and explosions translate a lot better than romantic indie comedies when you're trying to, you know, put something in Mandarin. So that's one thing. The other thing is China has historically had a cap on the number of American movies that can get into the Chinese market because they're trying to build up their own Hollywood.
That's a pretty powerful argument.
And the ones that get in have historically, and they may be in the process of changing this, had to have one of two things. They needed to be IMAX or 3D. And I don't know what things you're going to at the Kendall Square Cinema,
I don't think so.
Fabulous popcorn, though. 877, and you can bring your cafe latte into the theater. 877-301.
Then you have to stand in line to pay for parking.
8970. That's a problem. Let's take a bunch of calls for Kara Miller. We're talking about the blockbuster culture. Daniel in Somerville, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Daniel Gewirth. I'm a former music and occasional movie and theater critic for the Boston Herald. And I'm glad I'm not doing it today because, I do think that people love the shared experience and to get in on the popular items of television, music, and movies. But they've completely forgotten about what is great art, even what is great popular art. And I think it's largely generational. Because Hollywood decided, for instance, a long time ago, people under 40 weren't seeing movies. So they decided, let's concentrate on 20s and 30s. Then they discovered 20 years ago, people under 32 aren't seeing, over 32 aren't seeing movies. So let's go for teens and tweens and 23-year-olds. And they've created, the big box office over the first 2 weeks of the Hollywood cycle. And somehow they've created profit. But I think fewer people than ever think movies and music are truly important in their lives.
But Daniel,
no one is saying my life has changed because of Iron Man.
Man 3.
Well, Daniel, let me ask you one question,
though.
I don't know if Daniel's still there. But,
oh, he is.
But one thing I would maybe push back on is I talked to Brian Stelter of the New York Times a few weeks ago, and one of the things he said was, look, in some ways, we're in the golden age of television because it used to be that movies were where all the high art and the complex storytelling was. And now we've moved into a new era where movie stars are not afraid to be, you think about Glenn Close, people like that. They're not afraid to be on television. So I wonder, Daniel, if, movies and TV have switched a little bit and maybe for the more mature audiences, TV is the place where it's at.
Well, I personally think that cable premium TV is the most overrated artistic invention ever. You take away the nude scenes and the cursing and the extravagance, and an awful lot of those shows are not all that good. They're just racy, and they have heroes that are criminals and dope addicts and meth creators, and they're just like us. They're all middle-class people with complex problems, and the mafia in New Jersey is just like your average Italian-American family.
Wait, now you're crossing the line, Daniel. I was fine until you mentioned Tony Soprano, and now you're... Hey, Daniel, that's a great call. Thank you so much. Call us again soon. 877-301-8970. I sort of feel, without the hard evidence behind me, with the exception of that cable thing. I sort of feel like he does. Essentially, when you say who, we, that's the critical question. Who is the we? Forget the international we. The American we, they are targeting this to an audience that is perfectly happy with blockbusters, that doesn't want independent thinking, that want to just be part of this cult thing that's going on, whether it's Iron Man 3 or whether it's a new album by somebody who isn't quite as good as they used to be, but who everybody knows. You're looking at me like I'm wrong on this.
Well, okay. So first of all, the we outside the United States is now larger than the we inside the United States. So
point.
I don't think
that's
you can discount
point. No,
that.
I hear that.
But I don't want to completely malign all people under 25. I mean, honestly, these people, you know, when you look at something like Ocean's 11 and 12 and 13, and I think, do we have a clip? Let's listen.
Doesn't matter if we win,
as long as the casino loses.
Which means that we have to rig craps, blackjack, slots, and roulette, all in our favor.
Jeez, could you make it any more complicated?
So it's a pretty good movie, first of all.
What was that, Ocean's 11, the remix or something? Or what was that called?
That was Ocean's 13.
Oh, pardon me. Ocean's
that was Ocean's 13 when, you know, they were 12. Incorporating, I don't know what, Lady Gaga or something. But you know, that itself, right, was based on the Frank Sinatra movie. I mean, I think people like known quantities. And we've had for a long time, if you look at comic books or if you look at television shows, revivals of ideas and of stories.
Yeah, but how do you explain? I'm moving in your direction, but then as you're speaking, getting back to what Daniel said a minute ago, look at some of the great television shows, cable television shows that Daniel was disparaging, but I love. A huge percentage of these are led by people that the vast majority of viewers never saw before. Whether it is The Sopranos, I mean, I don't think many people knew James Gandolfini or Edie Falco. Did anyone know who John Hamm was before Mad Men? I'm sure there's an inside group. Essentially, they're almost going the opposite route. I mean, obviously, Bryan Cranston was known from his Malcolm in the Middle days, but was not the kind of star he was. So in the movie industry, they're going for the blockbuster and the huge star and spending the money. But one would argue in the world, and Bob Thompson, our friend from the Blyer Center at Syracuse, is with us quite regularly, one of the great experts on TV, these shows that are replacing movies in terms of quality to a degree, as you mentioned a minute ago, are essentially using unknowns and exposing them to the American people for the first time. So how does that fit that blockbuster theory?
That's somewhat true and somewhat not true, as you break, you know, like I mentioned about Kevin Spacey, for example.
Well, there are exceptions.
And Bryan Cranston, I mean, he wasn't unknown, but okay, but television shows have a different time frame. They have time to gain your attention, right?
That's
in
a
fact,
good point.
if your attention is not gained in the first season, you can just Netflix it on a Saturday and be ready for season two. When you're talking about movies, you have got a period of like 2 or 3 days to make this thing work. Afterwards, you know, CBS and NBC, they're all saying, no, this was a big flop. You look at something like Gravity, it cost $100 million to make, right? But in its first week, it did so well. It brought in $55 million. It's well on its way to becoming powerful. But you think it wouldn't have done that if they didn't have Sandra Bullock and George Clooney to go out and do the publicity for them? They don't need John Hamm to do that kind of opening weekend blitz.
So what happens to someone like Alice Munro, who, you know, academics all know her and people teach her and write in classes, but she's a Canadian short story writer.
Right.
And she just won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So she gets the little 15-minute little boost to her. People knowing about her, she gets like a little tiny little upswing, and that's it.
Yeah, well, the Oscars do that too for more sort of independent, highbrow movies. They always give you a bump. But I think there's no question that at the top, so Alice Munro clearly not at the top, but at the top, there is this aggregation of wealth that is strikingly, when I read about this, when I look at the evidence that Anita Alberci has gathered, it is strikingly like all the things we have heard about the sort of 99% and the 1%. So you look at, this is just last year's earnings. This is not net wealth. Last year, Madonna made $125 million.
Wow, good for her.
Yeah, she's doing well. Here's the fascinating thing about that earning. She had a recent album. It was a total flop. Because she also had a tour, and people are willing to pay a ton of money. I don't know if you guys ever go to concerts, but people are willing to pay a lot of money to see artists who they care about.
Yeah,
hundreds of dollars a ticket.
We never know what Madonna's going to wear to one of those gatherings.
That's why you pay
all
this
black leather or pasties or
one more quick one with Karen Miller from the Innovation Hub. We're talking about the blockbuster culture. Let's go to Dave in Milford. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Relatively quickly, Dave, if you will.
Hi, everybody. I got a gift of Spotify, which is the ability to go
view hundreds of thousands of songs mm-hmm. online
mm-hmm.
from my kids as a gift. What I found was, I said, this is great. I'll go out there and I'll find all this new music and everything. Well, I will tell you that after spending hours of searching all the new music for something I like, I don't have the time to manage, like maybe perhaps kids do, finding all this new stuff. So I depend upon the marketing, unfortunately, that steers me into what to try and then look at. And I think the whole thing, even on American Idol, most of the top 10 singers are better than the judges. So if you have marketing behind you, the American people will buy pretty much anything.
Yeah, and it's cyclic. I mean, like you were saying, you hear certain songs on the radio, then you know those songs. You don't have that much time. Those are the songs you pick. It's interesting. You mentioned American Idol, too. Simon Cowell was the third highest-earning celebrity last year. He brought in a cool $95 million.
Frightening. So what are you doing tonight and Saturday on Innovation Hub?
So Saturday we are talking about this, the future of the blockbuster and how that's going to shape entertainment. It's a really fascinating conversation. Tonight we talk with media theorist Doug Rushkoff about how technology is actually changing us as people. It's really interesting.
Okay, the voice you just heard is Kara Miller, who is the host of Innovation Hub. And as she said, you can catch her show. It's a great show tonight at 9 and Saturday mornings at 10. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for our Friday news quiz, Sibling Rivalry Edition, with the Flaherty brothers, Chip and Michael, facing off over the news of the week. They're the men behind Walden Media, which brought you Holes, The Watsons Go to Birmingham, and the whole Narnia series. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks so much for tuning in. See you tomorrow.